Hello and welcome. This is Karen Volo, the founder of Evolution and co-author of a book called Engage. And welcome to the Amazing Leaders series. We have an exciting guest with us today that I'm really thrilled to have on board here. Vinit Nayar is the former CEO of HCL Technologies, which is actually a company that we featured in our book, Engage. And he is also the founder of Sam Park Foundation. And he's one of the most recognized management leaders in the last decade. He actually took HCL Technologies in 2005 from a $0.7 billion company to a huge expansion and growth into a $4.7 billion company with over 85,000 employees and across 32 countries during a time really when everyone else was really struggling. So from 2005 to 2013, just this radical transformation for the company. And he's now currently working as a senior advisor for a number of different organizations with McKinsey, Global Talent Competitive Index, and just involved in a lot of different things. I'm really excited to have him on board so we can have some good conversation about a bit of the journey that he went through with HCL Technologies and then also a bit about what he's doing with Sam Park Foundation as well. So welcome, Vinit. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me, and a pleasure talking to you.
Well, I'm really excited about this. And actually, in my introduction, I forgot to mention, but this is going along with my first question, that you've written this book called Employees First, Customer Second. And that was one of the books that we had read that was really inspiring for us when we were doing the research for Engage as well. And Fortune magazine actually has considered this one of the world's most modern management ideas, putting the employees first and customer second. So let's dive right into that. And when you became the CEO for HCL Technologies, what made you decide to empower the employees in this way and kind of turn this pyramid upside down?
I think for any CEO at any particular time, if the objective is to transform an organization, you basically have only two choices. Either transform the organization based on the product you offer, which is what Apple, Google, Facebook do, or we came up with the fact that there is an alternate choice. And the alternate choice was that actually you can transform the organization on what we call the how axis, in terms of how does the organization execute, how does the organization function internally. And our assumption was that if you can increase the clock speed of the organization, you can actually outperform all your competitors despite the fact that you have the same product, the same markets, and the same proposition. And to be able to walk down this path, we asked ourselves three fundamental questions. The first was, what is the business we are in? And the answer was to create unique, differentiated value for our customers. The second question, where does this unique, differentiated value gets created and who creates it? And our answer was that our employees in the interface of our company and our customers create this unique, differentiated value. And hence, third and the most obvious question is, if the employees are the unique differentiation or employees are creating the unique differentiation, then what should the role of managers and management be? And that answer was the fact that the role of managers and management should be nothing but to enthuse, encourage, and enable those employees so that you can grow faster. And that led to the birth of what we call employee first, customer second.
How did the employees adapt to this type of thinking? Was it something they embraced very quickly, or was it something that took a little bit of time, or was there any resistance? I'm just curious as to, you know, how the whole organization as a whole started with this. And at that point, how many employees did you have? I guess it was 2005.
So in 2005, we had 25,000 employees in 32 countries. And by 2013, we had about 87,000-90,000 employees in, you know, life was true in 2005, and that became more and more true as the recession came in and the CEO started behaving in what I would call a very irrational fashion, with an assumption that employees are a problem rather than the solution. The problem number one was that the trust between the management and the employee was very poor. And therefore, irrespective of what any employee may say, they would come back and say that, and therefore that would really not work. The second important question was the fact that the employees truly believed that there was nothing, not the employees, but the management really truly believed that there was nothing which needed to change. And that is true with a lot of organizations because we slice and dice the data to look good, and therefore we start believing in our own lies. And therefore the need for change did not exist in the middle management and the senior management. That was the second aspect. And the third aspect was that transformation and any change is looked at with huge amount of suspicion by the external world. So the external world was not willing to believe that we had any hope in hell that we can transform ourselves. And therefore, even if we did what we said we would, and even if we were this new shining company which would create incrementally more value for our customers, nobody was willing to believe in. So in that environment, there was what I would call a significant resistance to change, which we faced at that particular time.
That's interesting. I mean, it seems like you really need to work a bit from the inside out when you're doing this type of thing. What would you say are the biggest benefits when you're dealing with such organizational change that is focused from the inside out?
So what really happens, I believe, is that increasingly as I meet more and more employees, this generation of employees do not want to be managed. They do not want a ringmaster as their manager, and they do not want to dance to anybody's tune. They do not want to be commanded. They wanted to be involved. Now, while that a lot of organizations are seeing that as a challenge for demotivation, and therefore the employee engagement numbers are at the lowest, we at HCL saw this as the biggest positive we could get from this change which was happening in this generation. So we said that if we can, A, create a need for change by saying that the company is really broken and honestly admitting it. Number two, define a vision for tomorrow, which is very compelling, a vision which is not that of the company, but a vision where an employee sees himself or herself in that vision and gets extremely passionate about the vision. And then as a third step, we transfer the ownership of this change to the employees to make it happen. So instead of what we call an outside-in initiative or a strategy or in our 10 by 10 plan or a 20 by 20 plan, if we say that, you know what, we would launch a series of experiments which will want you to initiate so that we as an organization move from where we are today to where we want to go. And each one of you will get an opportunity to lead it. And therefore, we inverted the organization pyramid and made the employees responsible for the transformation. So that led to an inside-out transformation. An inside-out transformation results in longer periods of decision-making, but very short periods of implementation and adoption. And that is the reason by the time we hit 2006, we've landed some large deals. By the time we hit 2007, we had started outgrowing our competitors. By the time recession came in 2008, we were one of the few companies in the world which kept on growing, and we never saw a degrowth. So all that was happening because internally the employees believed that they are doing what they want to do rather than doing what somebody else is telling them to do. So therefore, my take is that if you really truly want to transform an organization in perpetuity, then it has to come from within. And if you want it to come from within, it is a three-step process of creating dissatisfaction with today, creating a vision for tomorrow, and then creating the need for change internally through multiple experiments which the employees can initiate it, and then the transformation will be a reversible process.
Were you using the word experiments with the employees? We're going to do these experiments and see how it goes.
So that's a very interesting question, and I think that was the biggest find for me in this whole journey, the word initiative versus the word experiment. Whenever in the initial days I used the word initiative, I could see that employees were waiting for the initiative to fail or succeed, and the employees were acting like a judge jury, but not participating in that initiative succeeding or actually failing. The moment I converted that into what I call experiments and said, hey, this is what is broken. This is where we want to go, and let's try this out and see if this experiment would work. People suddenly started seeing as they were involved, they started shaping it, they started changing it, and the number of those so-called initiatives converted to experiments started succeeding was significantly higher. I can tell you whether it was a 360-degree appraisal where 100,000 employees did my appraisal and the results were published on the web, or it was a service desk where troubled any employee can open a ticket on the company and we'll close it in a limited period of time, or any of those real class initiatives which transformed HCL, all of them were changed by the employees after the initial launch. So had we stuck with the initial launch, we would have got all of them wrong. Because we launched them as experiments, the employees shaped them and changed them, though marginally, but very instinctively and very importantly, they changed it. And the real reason for the success of all those experiments, all those ideas which really succeeded and made employee first a reality in our organization was because of those finer changes which the employees made. And that is the reason we constantly use this word experiment and had more and more participation from our employees who shaped these ideas to increase the probability of success.
That's fascinating that it could be just one shift of one word that can make such a difference. And I see that, you know, by using that word experiment, people would feel more a part of it and be more collaborative and involved in the whole process. Why do you think more leaders aren't embracing this? I mean, you've given a great example over almost, you know, now we're looking at 10 years, basically last decade, but it just seems to be slow coming into a lot of established organizations and companies that they're not taking this on fully. Why do you think that is?
I think there are a couple of reasons. Number one, in that decade, we had seen significant market value being created by leaders using products. So Facebook, Google, Amazon, all these companies came during that period. And they, what I call, hogged the mind share of CEOs. And therefore, the CEOs were in what I call a constant pursuit of an innovative idea which would get them out of the well they are in. And therefore, they were constantly investing in either a new product, a new idea, or a new acquisition. And that is what they constantly pursued. There were very few examples during that decade which showed that actually investing in employees by trusting them, by accepting them rather than rejecting them, could actually unlock the value the company wanted to create. And HCL was one of the unique companies there. There were also Southwest Airline and, you know, Gore. And some of the companies were there, but there were no Facebook and Google kind of companies which were right out there in your face on the Fortune cover every year, which the CEOs could copy. I think that is now changing. After Employee First, Customer Second, as the book was written, and you'll be happy to know it sold over 100,000 copies, people started looking at this with interest. And therefore, when I started talking to people, they started looking for such experiments within their organization and saying, can that happen? And as those experiments are increasingly becoming successful, they are understanding that these are easy to do and creating high impact compared to innovations which are tough to do, external product innovations which are tough to do and have high failure rates. So I think the adoption is slowly increasing, and I believe that it will become a momentum. It will become a momentum because you really don't have a choice as a CEO. When in the period I was talking about in 2005 to 2013-14, the employees had limited choice because they were limited number of jobs. And therefore, they heard all the command and control language, and they were willing to be managed. No more now. People have choices, and they have interesting startups to go to, interesting places to go to. So you want to lose all the best talent which you have in your organization if you are not careful about reinventing the culture of your organization and making it relevant for the best and brightest in the world, because you, as an organization, would need to transform to be relevant to the digital revolution which is happening all around us.
We've talked about this in Engage as well, and this pressure that the business world is having from this millennium generation that is really looking for very purpose-driven companies, and that really now research is starting to show from, you know, Deloitte, McKinsey, and all those organizations how purpose-driven companies are really the ones that are going to drive business forward and be successful into the future. So I think, you know, you had mentioned earlier how you motivate and inspire people is through having this very clear vision of getting them involved and feeling like they're a part of it, which seems to be really the key to, like you said, untapping the value in the organization. You've talked a lot about managers versus leaders, and I'd love to have you share with us what you see as the difference between the two, and then really how can you inspire more leaders inside of an organization?
I would say that the manufacturing era or the manufacturing transformation revolution we saw brought in this emphasis towards repeatable tasks, standardization of processes, and quality. And because of which we had this command and control army kind of structures where this word manager was born. Manager in French is basically to be able to break a horse into submission, manage. As the knowledge economy started evolving and as collaboration became very important for organizations for the teams to come together in a collaborative enterprise, which could not always be structured in a command and control structure. As those needs in the business started coming in, the manager started failing in his duty predominantly because he or she was used to managing it in only one way, which is what we call the instruction-led. And those are the companies who started suffering, and that's the reason you do not see too much innovation coming from large companies during that era is because the managers were not focused on innovation, they were focused on managing. Now, the leaders of tomorrow are the people who understand that actually the future is about ideas, and the future is about inspiring people to do what they want to do and inspiring people to do some revolution work or some creative work, which is not instruction-led. And therefore, the innovation required in the interface of an employee. Just take an air hostess walking up to you and telling you that, you know, you'd say, do you have a New York Times? And she says, no, there is no New York Times, and walks away. Compared to another air hostess who comes in and saying, yes, we don't have New York Times, but why don't I try and get you something which you have not seen before? You know what? This is an Irish paper, which I love reading, and there is a humor column in that. You will love it. So why don't I bring that to you? Now, here is an empowered air hostess who is interested in the business of the company and interested in the passenger, creates a unique proposition which is not repeatable, and that passenger is not going to forget. And actually, this happened to me, so I will never forget that airline. So inspired leaders give the space to people to be able to create the innovation, and therefore those organizations which had those inspired leaders who understand the leadership concept of influence rather than manage started succeeding more and more. There is one other aspect which was changing dramatically during this last decade, which is from the three P's, which we have always been reading in marketing. The new three P evolution was about planet, people, and profits. So the new leaders were expected not just to be what I call profit obsessed, but to demonstrate that they will manage the combination of being responsible to the planet, being responsible to the people, and responsible to the profits. So as those kind of leaders, expectation from leaders started moving away only from profit and also demonstrating that you are good human beings, the old management style started collapsing. And that's the reason we started seeing the birth of some new leaders who could actually balance these three new P's, inspire people to get more out of them, and stop being ringmasters and start being what we call inspiring leaders.
We speak the same language. we're really big on you know, collaboration and creativity and allowing the ideas to come from within the organization. I mean, we are seeing a big shift, and this triple P bottom line that people are starting to talk about, I'm a little surprised sometimes that it's not more widespread, but I think it's just a matter of time. And I think a lot of business leaders tend to be so wrapped up in the day-to-day that they sometimes don't get a chance to look outside so much. Would you agree with that, or what are your thoughts on that?
So I would say that, you know, we are just coming out of a phase post-recession where the shareholders had a dominant stranglehold on listed companies. And they had a unique power of hiring and firing CEOs and chairmen, and therefore most organizations were run out of what I call profit objectives. Now, as regulations are running ahead of these companies, as interest groups like the NGOs are running ahead and making people aware of the kind of disasters these companies are creating, British Petroleum is a standing example, these companies slowly and the shareholders are realizing that sole purpose of profit is not going to get us where we want to go, and therefore you need to get the planet into being. I think the planet consciousness and the profit consciousness have come to be. The people consciousness, unfortunately, has not come in, because they can understand that if we don't do planet, our profits will suffer. They have still not correlated the fact that if we are not sensitive to people, it's not the old unionized way, but if we are not able to inspire people, we will not able to attract the best and brightest in our culture, we will lose a competitive advantage. I think that idea has not sunk in so far in the minds of the shareholders, in the minds of the boards, in the minds of the CEO. And that's the reason I think we continuously see employees as the so-called line item of overheads or a problem. And every cost issue tends to be what we call getting rid of some employees. I think that vocabulary needs to change with more and more examples coming in that actually these three P's, there is a reality about managing these three P's in the new generation. And that's the only way you would be what we call a socially responsible organization who has the right to exist in a social environment. Otherwise, you will lose the right to exist in a social environment. And as people are getting their voices bigger and bigger, I think that right is going to get exercised. And therefore, people are going to constantly ask, why is democracy very relevant for our country? And why is democracy not very relevant for the organizations in which we spend majority of our time? I think that conversation is going to start. And if you want to run ahead, like you ran ahead of regulation by complying with the regulations before they came up, and that became your competitive advantage, CEOs will have to run ahead of this whole people momentum towards the fact that do they have a say in the organization? Is there a democracy of decision-making? Is there an involvement in decision-making? Are you empowering, enthusing, and encouraging those employees? Before that voice becomes stronger, I think some smart CEOs will understand this and run ahead of it.
Let's hope they catch on really fast, right?
that's our hope, yes.
Let me ask you, just before we leave your time here with HCL, what would you say during your years there has been your biggest lesson for you?
I think the biggest lesson for me is that honesty of saying I don't know has the biggest transformative impact in an organization. Fortunately or unfortunately, a CEO gets trapped in the logic of the fact that he or she needs to know everything. At least the employees and the management team expects that, and therefore you are constantly asked questions, and you're constantly expected to give answers, give direction. And because of that, the whole organization gears itself and becomes extremely sophisticated about how to make slick presentations to the CEO and how to hoodwink the CEO so that they look good, because the purpose is not growth. The purpose is to look good, to get the next promotion, to get the next raise, to get the next seat, to get the seat on the board. The moment in HCL I started saying, I don't know, as my first answer to all the problems, I think, a revolution started happening. So they started saying, if this guy does not know, then I'm supposed to know. And when the decision-making came back out of the CEO into the hands of the middle managers and then to the hands of the employees, the quality of decision-making started improving. The ownership of decision-making started improving. And therefore, that role reversed in terms of the CEO who's supposed to give direction in all decisions, and hence the consequences of those decisions were always with the CEO. And suddenly the decisions would be taken at bottom of the pyramid. The quality of decision-making improved. The accountability of decision-making improved. So my biggest lesson in HCL was the fact that I think we as leaders should use I don't know much more than we normally do.
So I have a question here for you now. I'm just curious as to what you think businesses can do to have a greater impact or a greater positive impact. What should they be doing? What's your opinion on that?
I think we discussed that a while back in terms of the fact that businesses have to start thinking in the three P's, the new three P's, which is the planet, profit, and people. And you will use the right word in your question, which is the impact. And more businesses should understand that the word impact would not mean stock exchange market valuation. And actually, stock exchange market valuations will also get impacted by the impact you create on planet and people. And therefore, your strategy of how you are socially responsible citizen is going to increasingly become important. And therefore, if you really truly want to create an impact as an organization, and that is the reason of your existence, then you have to think extremely carefully about planet, which I presume most people are doing, but also about people. And it's not just about how many people you hire and where you hire, but the people you have, are they really energized? Are they really inspired? Are you being fair to them? Are you giving them the opportunity? And is the cause of your success your people? And those questions are going to be significantly more important than they were in the past in your ability to create impact in the future.
Well, that's great. I want to take a little bit of time also to focus on the Sam Park Foundation that you've founded. I understand you had founded that back in 2004. It's a nonprofit organization, and I love the purpose of creating 1 million smiles. I think it's fabulous. And from what I've heard, you seem to be taking on education for an entire state of India using some of the models that you've used in the business world. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that and why you decided to take on this type of a project?
So one of the learnings of Employee First, Customer Second was the fact that you can bring about a dramatic transformation of the fortunes of an organization by changing one thing, whatever that is. And the question I asked when at HCL we became 100,000 people is that if employees truly could create the transformation for HCL, where our market valuation went from a low of $1.4 billion to a high of $20 billion, if employees can enable that, can we bring about that fundamental change in our society? And not even within the organization, where I still, as a CEO, command some control on the employees, but where I command influence. So we took education as a means and said there are 150 million children in the government schools in India. And they are spread across 700,000 schools. The report, the Education Asar report, which came out in 2014 recently, said the following, that in grade 3, 67% of the children cannot recognize numbers beyond 99. And 93% of grade 3 children cannot do division. So when you have 150 million children with these kind of percentages, there was an alarm bell ringing in my mind. And this is despite the fact that government has done whatever it takes to increase their investment in education, and these are far-flung schools in the poorer parts of India, the education outcome is not improving. So we said that at Sampark Foundation, we will act like a catalyst and bring about a fundamental transformation in the way education is delivered to these 150 million children. And the way we brought about that was a research report which said that a child, when he's in the class or she's in the class, for the first 10 minutes has 70% retention, and after 10 minutes has actually the retention comes down to about 20%. If you use toys and stories and visual tools, that retention percentage from 20% goes up to 70-80%. So we said if we can actually bring a combination of fun toys for maths, folklore stories along with those toys, easy to use teacher training tools, and combine all that and create an initiative by the teacher, for the teacher, and run by the teacher, we potentially could transform the way education is delivered. So currently, we have actually crossed our vision of a million smiles. We are impacting 2.8 million children in 45,000 schools across India. And hopefully, we would get to 10 million children in the next 3 years across close to 120,000 schools using this pedagogy, which is bringing about dramatic change in the learning outcomes of the children on the ground. And all this was just a dollar per child per annum. So that's what Sampark Foundation is doing in the world today.
That's amazing. You probably should change that 1 million smiles to 1 billion smiles because you far bypassed it now.
That's true. At
the way you're able to ramp up and leverage things, I have no doubt that you'll reach that 1 billion point in the not-so-distant future. But that's fantastic.
I hope you're right.
I have also heard that, you know, we can change the world in one generation if we start with the children. So I think the work you're doing is incredibly important, and I hope that it's something that will be duplicatable in other countries and other areas. Is that kind of your plan too, or are you just taking it for India right now and then we'll see what happens?
No. We're planning to reach Africa. So in India, we are planning to go from maths to English to science, and hopefully next year we should be in some parts of Africa with this experiment. So no, this is not going to be restricted to India. India was what I call easy to do workshop, because we could easily get, so these are all done in government schools with partnership of the government. And the critical aspect of this, that is the reason I'm saying it is linked to the Employee First Transformation Initiative, is the fact that it is owned by the government, it is owned by the teachers, and we are just the catalyst action. So therefore, you would see this trend, because now we have implemented this at very large scale, the learning outcomes measured are having high impact, and therefore we are going to take this to other countries and saying, hey, if you want to adopt this, this is open source, and we're going to invest all our money in transferring this open source to you, dear government of any country or state government of any country, and we will help you implement this, but you need to take the ownership of making this happen, and you don't have to pay anything to anybody. So that's the trick.
That's what I like to call a triple win. Everybody wins. It's a no-brainer. Why not do this, right?
Sure.
You are an exemplary example of, you know, leadership on all levels of how you can really make a big impact again. So going back towards the business world a bit, if you could give one piece of advice for leaders of businesses or organizations, what would that be?
I would believe that, you know, we as business leaders are constantly searching for zones of competitive advantage. What can we do which our competitor has not thought about so far? And if you could imagine yourself thinking about a new market, a new product, a new proposition, a new customer, or a new pricing strategy, you know it and I know it, that everybody has thought about it, and it becomes extremely complex and extremely risky to put all your bet on that idea. You need to constantly do that, but it becomes extremely risky for you to do all your bet in that area. So my suggestion would be that this whole people idea of the fact that, can you increase the clock speed of the organization? Can you increase the innovation of the organization? You know, when we launched this employee first innovation, where our employees were creating the innovation for our customers, in the first year itself, we created $4.6 million of incremental profit out of the ideas our employees suggested to our customers. $4.6 million of additional profit in the first year of that innovation experiment itself. So I would believe that there is a significant amount of competitive advantage waiting to be unlocked if you start focusing on building competitive advantage around the culture, around the people practices, and around getting more out of the people you already have. And therefore, if you start seeing the people strategy as a market-facing strategy, value-creating strategy, revenue-creating and market cap-creating strategy, you will start pursuing it with the same intellect you use to pursue your new market strategy. And once you do that, I believe you can potentially create a competitive advantage which your competition has not thought about so far. So that would be my advice to my fellow leaders.
Fantastic. Well, let's hope lots of people embrace that when they hear this interview. You really have been such an inspirational leader for so many. I'm just curious, as kind of our last question to wrap this up, what do you want to be remembered by most in your life? What will be your legacy?
So I would believe that a person should be remembered by the idea he launched, or the idea, an obvious idea he convinced everybody is worth looking at. And my belief is that the person should not be remembered for his deeds, but the person should be remembered by the idea he leaves behind for people to build on, people to experiment, people to profit from, and people to gain from. And that idea is this whole people centricity, experimenting with people centricity to try and get higher profits and being more responsible corporate citizens. So when I'm gone, if the idea gains higher legs and more people experiment and adopt it in their own form, I think that would have been a great, what I could start of a revolution, which I was part of, and that would be good.
I think you've already started the revolution here, Vinit. I like to use an analogy of you drop a pebble in the water and the ripple effects. You have not dropped any sort of pebble. You've dropped like a huge boulder, and it's got major ripple effects. So,
I hope so.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time, for sharing your insights with us. You know, continue the fabulous work you're doing in whatever ways, because it seems like whichever direction you end up taking, you can have a really big impact. And the world needs inspirational leaders like you. So thank you again so much for your time.
Thank you so much, and it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.